Get a job.
Work hard.
And one day you can retire and do the things you want.
That's the typical formula for daily life in the modern world.
And it works. For lots of people, this kind of life is perfect.
But it's not for us. And I'm guessing that it's not for you either.
I'm David Allan Patali.
And I'm Carmen Allan Patali. And together we run the content company Red Platypus.
I'm also a published fiction author.
And we have two young daughters who keep us on our toes.
We've both said no to well-paid jobs in favour of pursuing our creative paths. And we want to walk them with you.
Freelancer, digital nomad, artist, creative, self-employed. Whatever you want to call it, if you work for yourself and want to keep it that way, or want to be free from the 9-to-5 and don't know where to start, we want to help.
We're going on a journey to speak to committed creatives, people who are all in, who have made highly successful businesses out of their creativity, and ask them how they do it while retaining the magic.
Because while we think inspiration is good, we've come to learn that process is vital.
Welcome to the Committed Creative Podcast, your toolkit for the creative life you want.
Here's to going all in and becoming a committed creative.
Well, hello and welcome to this episode of the Committed Creative Podcast.
Hello.
I'm David Allan Patali.
And I'm Carmen Allan Patali. And we thought we would jump on the pod this week and have one of our chats, which normally happens about twice a season. We are normally the hosts of the podcast, but in cases like these, we become also the subjects.
What are you going to ask me, Carmen?
I've got my list of questions. No, not really.
Well, the thing we wanted to talk to you about today is some of the things that have been really pushing us creatively, artistically, in a business sense, things that have really pushed us out of our comfort zone. Because, you know, I think it's like the challenging time of the year, particularly in Australia. You know, for about 4 months of the year, nobody really does any work, let's be honest. You know, it's the kind of the summertime, you know, December, January, February, to a lesser extent, March. Mm. And then between March and December, that is the meat of the year. And we are really, really, I think, deep into the hard work period of the year. So a lot of those challenges have been thrown at us and also a lot of terrible weather. So you've just got to keep soldiering on.
I think it's helpful that there's terrible weather because you have no motivation to go outside, which, you know, you may as well sit at your desk all day.
That's right. But one of the things that really stuck out was I've been teaching a series of writing classes. It's the same thing I did last year, but slightly tweaked and much improved. It's called On the Right Track. So it's 6 classes where I teach a lot of writing techniques from character, theme, plot.
Creative writing.
First draft, second draft, publication. So anyone who turns up, but mostly writers here in Perth's northern suburbs, and it's through the city of Wanneroo. It was very successful last year. You know, it was fully booked out. But this year, when we decided to run it again, to be quite blunt, it hasn't been as popular compared to last year, or at least it initially wasn't. We really struggled to get enough people to come to the first session. In fact, there were 20 spaces and we only had 10 show up, so 50%. So last year it was fully booked out for every single class. Now, in a different set of circumstances last year, WA did not have any COVID. That was not even a factor. So everyone was just sort of itching to do something. This year, however, lots of COVID out and about. So perhaps that was a factor in it. And some of the messaging I had from the organizers, you know, they were saying, look, you know, to be fair, we need more than 10 to show up, or we need at least a minimum of 10 to show up for every single one. So there was some doubt as to whether the rest of the series could go ahead.
They were talking about cancelling it, weren't they?
They were. And the sort of, I don't know, fair-minded part of me was like, oh, okay, that's understandable. There's COVID, there's all these things. If we don't have the people, we're not going to get them. But Carmen, your reaction was a little different.
I was like, hell no. This is your opportunity to help so many people. I know how valuable your classes are. You get such great feedback. It was just a case of not enough people knew about it. So I knew we just had to improve that. Plus, not to mention, you know, that's quite a number of thousands of dollars that you were going to miss out on. So I was like, no way, this is not happening. So I went on a massive social media drive. I recruited one of my friends who's a real gun at this, and basically got Dave's face out in front of more people, and I think it paid off. What happened, Dave?
I think it paid off quite a bit. Well, we had at least 16 people for every class booking in. And
that's from having like not two so many. People.
Yeah, for the follow-up. So it's been great. And what's really been good is that a core group of dedicated people have emerged, and they are the ones who are going to come to every single class, which is really great and really encouraging. So I think it was a really good reminder, you know, don't say no. Don't take no for an answer. Don't let things just sort of slide.
Don't make excuses. Mm. Like, it's so easy to say, oh, it's COVID. I mean, how often have you heard that phrase in the last couple of years?
It's a crutch for everyone.
Yeah, it's just a blame game. Just you're responsible for your own actions and make it happen, you know. Fight through the challenges, and it's really rewarding. It felt a lot more rewarding this year than it did last year when you sold out the spots. So
that's a good point, actually. Last year was easy because all that happened was we put together the classes, the City of Wanneroo advertised it, and they booked out like that. It was easy. This year, you know, so there's nothing to learn from an easy experience other than to get your invoice in quick. You know, but a difficult experience like that this year was actually really instructive. It forced us to go on the defensive and then to go on the attack, to actually look at how can we actually do this. So social media campaign, getting things out there, putting it in newsletters, doing live videos on Instagram, you know, just harassing people to sign up. But one thing, I don't know, this is a real cricket analogy, but Shane Warne, the bowler, used to say one wicket buys two. So if you can get one wicket, you can get the next person out pretty quickly because you get momentum. And the great thing about this is I've got lots of other things coming up that, because I've got momentum from this on the right track, I'm now in the frame of mind to promote them even harder. Mm. So that's been a really good thing too. So once you get your momentum up, you can carry that into the next thing and the next thing and the next thing and the next thing.
Snowballs.
Snowball effect. I mean, I've got a free event coming up with three other riders where we're all on stage up here in the northern suburbs. The tickets are free, so I hope it sells out.
It should do,
but I've been pushing that really hard, and I've got a couple of other things where I'm appearing on stage as the interviewer. I'm interviewing people for writing festivals and those kinds of things, and that's pushing me out of my comfort zone. I like to think I'm good at interviewing, but it's...
You definitely are.
Yeah, but it's stressful. It's not my comfort zone. I'm always a bit on edge, which I think is probably a good thing.
Definitely.
Because I enjoy doing it and I always like to put my hand up for it, but I'm always a bit like, you got 50 minutes. My worst nightmare would be to interview somebody who, if you ask them a question, they just immediately answer it. That's probably a tip if you're ever being interviewed.
What with a one-word answer?
Yeah, or a brief answer. So yeah, that's probably just a little side note. If you're ever, as a business owner or a creative, being interviewed, the question is not being asked to you so you can answer it. You're being invited to tell a story.
Yes, tell stories in your answers. It's so much more engaging. Whoever's listening gets so much more out of it.
Yeah. And it's really helpful also to the person interviewing you, because at most they've got 20 questions up their sleeve. And I've seen interviews where the interviewer burns those 20 questions in the first 5 minutes.
Oh, painful.
It's painful. If you're not there to speak, don't go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tell us stories. Anyway, yeah. Tell us anything. But yeah, but back to me. No, I'm actually done. I'm done. But I think that's been really good to push me out of my comfort zone and just to remind me that, you know, you've got to fight for these things. You've got to scrap for stuff.
Mm.
It's very easy to, in the wintry confines of my writing room here where we're recording this, to just sort of bury yourself and just get on with the quiet work. But you've got to get it out there, and you've actually got to connect it to people. It's like the beginning of the year. What was that book that we read? It was from, I think it's Seth Godin. About artists often struggle because they see the commercial side of things as totally divorced from their artistic process, which is a good thing in an influence way. Like, yeah, you shouldn't make stuff just so you can sell it, because that would dilute your art. But at the same time, you put a lot of blood, sweat and tears into making this thing. Get it out into people's hands. Yes. You shouldn't be ashamed of it. And no one's going to do it but you.
It's like what they say. You know, the most successful products aren't the best products. They're the products that have been marketed the best.
That's right.
which unfortunately, if you have the best product but you're terrible at speaking about how good it is, then what's the point? No one will find out about it.
It's like, yeah, there's two ways to play Scrabble, isn't there? You can create beautiful words or you can get double word score.
Not to say your art shouldn't be beautiful, no, the best it can be.
No, exactly. But I know exactly. But
it's a funny analogy.
It is. And how about you, Carmen? What have you been into lately? You've had a lot of different clients coming and asking things of you, and
yes,
different roles. You've got a new thing going on?
Yes, sometimes I feel like I'm a sucker for punishment because I really like to push myself to the nth degree, which, you know, is very rewarding, but also sometimes I get halfway into something and I think, what the frick am I doing? Have I jumped in with 2 feet too fast? I don't know. So these past couple of weeks, I've had to have a think about something that was asked of me, which basically revolves around this networking group that I'm part of. And we meet every week. There's more than 52 people in the group. So you can imagine. And there's a requirement to go to the meeting, so everyone comes. Plus we have visitors. So, you know, normally there's about 60 people in the room. Anyway, there's someone who's nominated each year to get up and do a 5-minute education session for every single meeting. So that's 52 education sessions over the year. Maybe there's a break for Christmas, I'm not quite sure. Anyway, they're currently handing over all the roles of this group, and a number of people asked me to put my hand up for the education session and to talk each week for 5 minutes on various topics of my choice, just as long as it's providing value to the businesses in the room and that they're getting a lot of information out of it and, you know, that they're taking away learnings, I suppose. So not simply about copywriting. I want to talk a lot about business, about marketing, about self-doubt, daily struggles as a small business owner, that kind of thing. But anyway, so it's a huge commitment, and I must admit, I did think about it for a good week because, you know, to make a presentation every week is quite time consuming. But I realized that if I did this thing, it had a number of benefits which outweighed perhaps what could be seen as a hassle, which really I see as an opportunity, of putting together this presentation each week. So some of the benefits were, I become more visible within the networking group because they get to hear me speak for 5 minutes every week, which is more than anyone else in the room gets to speak for. So that is a definite benefit.
It's not bad.
The other benefit is that I realized I can repurpose the content that I produce for this presentation in multiple ways. So what I'm going to do is, recently I started a Facebook group called The Copy Club. If you're not yet a part of it, I highly recommend it, even if I do toot my own horn.
Should I join it? No, I'm not part of it. I'm part of it.
You are part of it. I want to get you to do some presentations.
I will.
You have a lot to offer. But
get out of my comfort zone.
But in that group, it's all about creating kick-ass copy that converts. So if you're a small business owner, whether in you're in a creative business or not, I highly recommend you jump into that group because every day I share copywriting tips to improve your writing efforts for your business. And once a week, I go live with a masterclass. So it only makes sense that I repurpose the content that I do in this weekly presentation when it suits to the Copy Club group on Facebook.
And here's a tip. Something I teach creative writing students is that your second draft of the same thing is always better.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe by the time you get to do the Copy Club, it'll be the same thing but refined.
It will actually be extended in some ways.
Okay.
And it's helpful because if people ask me questions after my networking group, I can answer those questions in the masterclass, because obviously I get 5 minutes to present in the business group, but I'm going to speak for about 45 minutes in this masterclass each week. So I'm repurposing it for that. I'm also repurposing it for social media, also repurposing it. I'm going to write a blog post each week for our website, also repurposing it in our newsletter each week, and possibly might mention topics on this podcast. So it has at least 5 uses. The one thing that I'm going to do can be replicated 5 times in various ways, But obviously, in the long run, it will probably end up saving me time. And the most importantly, it is committing me to actually doing it each week. Because if I do this 5-minute presentation, then it commits me to doing the masterclass and so on. So there's multiple benefits. So even though it seems like a lot of work, I think it will pay off.
Is that something that you would recommend to other people to do? That you have one thing, but you can use it 5 ways?
Yes. Hmm. Yes. People sometimes don't want to do that because they're like, oh, but then people are going to see my message 5 times. But that is definitely not the case. If you post something on social media, the chances of your audience seeing it are so slim, unless it's a paid sponsored post, obviously. And then even if you send out a newsletter each week, you know, not everybody reads it. And if you write a blog post, not everyone's going to see that either. So even if they see the message twice, they might not even take it in until the 3rd time. But chances are they're only going to see it once. So highly recommend repurposing. It saves so much time. It is really a good content writing tip for your business.
Yeah, you've always got to try different things. Do things in a slightly different way. I read a great quote the other day where someone said, I have 20 years experience, but that's not true. I just have 1 year of experience repeated 20 times. So it's not about doing the same thing over and over. It's about trying it in different ways, right?
Yeah.
Trying to do different things.
Well, you can repurpose it in different ways, but you're essentially delivering the same message. But the thing is, people aren't going to see it 5 times.
No. Well, it's got me thinking. I mean, I've got my writing course to relaunch again later this year, so we're going to do it in a slightly different way with different opportunities and different things that we've learned from the first time around. So first time doing anything, it's good, but it could be better. But then you do it the second time and you keep improving and you do it a different way and on and on and on and on and on. That's probably something that I've really learned from you this year, actually, Carmen. It's like, just get it done, just do it. Don't ever think it, just do it. Get it done, get it off the to-do list and poof, it's gone. Yeah. Whereas I tend to not overthink, but take a bit too long on certain things. But yeah, now I've been changing my ways.
But the thing is, if you take longer to do it, you're still going to make the same mistakes. It's just going to take you longer to make them.
Or you'll never do it. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
So often, like, people don't do something because they're nervous about getting it wrong or making a mistake. But all they're doing is prolonging that mistake. If you just do it quickly, you make the mistake faster, then you can move on, learn and improve at a rapid speed. So just do the thing.
Can I share something? I've actually got I just thought of this thing as we've spoken about that. I've got a class tonight on writing second drafts, and there's a story that I'm going to tell in it about why making mistakes is good, why improvisation is good. So I was listening to a podcast the other day about the making of the movie The Empire Strikes Back. Your favorite movie, isn't it, Carmen?
I've never seen it.
So anyway, after Star Wars came out, biggest movie ever, basically, just box office smash. George Lucas, the original director, says to his old friend, Irvin Kershner, who was actually his university professor, he's a very well-respected filmmaker, very serious filmmaker, and he said, look, Irvin, I'd like you to make The Empire Strikes Back. And Irvin goes, and he says, you've got to make this a success, because if it's a failure, that's the end of Star Wars. If you can make it good, it'll go on. So no pressure, man. No pressure at all. So Irvin goes, okay, I'll do it, but on one condition. I want total control. I don't want you breathing over my shoulder. I need complete artistic control. So Kershner takes over, and he's like, what a mistake that was, because George was like the expert. Everything went wrong on the set. Nothing worked. All the stuff kept breaking. And there's this scene where C-3PO, the robot, gets blown up, and then they put him back together and put him in kind of like a backpack on Chewbacca's back, the Wookiee dude. This is terrible trying to explain Star Wars to a non-fan.
Sounds ridiculous.
Anyway, so they needed this broken robot's head to move and his arm to go up and down. So when he's talking, it looks like he's talking, right? So they spent $100,000 on this animatronic box that would motivate the different parts of this character. Trouble was, they rolled tape, action, didn't work. Nothing they tried worked. And the prop department guy said, leave it with me. So Kershner's sweating buckets, going, oh my God, I've I've blown $100,000 on this thing. This movie is going to be a flop. This is terrible. 20 minutes later, the prop guy comes back and says, come have a look at this. And they go into the room, and there's the malfunctioning bit of kit. All of a sudden, it's working. It's working perfectly. And Kirshner's like, how did you do it? And he looks over, and the guy, the prop guy, is on the other side of the room with a fishing line. And he's attached the fishing line to the robot. And he's just tugging it. And he's like, great, bring it to the set immediately.
You paid him.
$100,000 for that. And so Kirshner goes, he says this great quote about it. He goes, look, when things don't work, you've got to use improvisation. You can't be thrown by these things. And you have to assume that you can make it work. I love that.
I love it. So he paid $100,000 for a fishing line.
Yeah. But he recovered from the mistake, right? But I love that. You have to assume you can make it work. He could have been like, oh, we've wasted all this money. Scrap everything. Brr, I'll be in my trailer. But meanwhile, someone else thought, hang on, there's an opportunity here to just do a hack, to do something cool, do something different. And then that happened. And they're like, right, great, roll with it. Let's go. And that's the spirit that movie was made in. It was like, everything gets stuffing up. They've made a way to make it work. And then that went on to become a massive success. So if you've got to do something, find a way or make a way.
Yeah.
So that's, yeah, to loop back to our original problem, you know, I can't sell any tickets to this bloody writing class. Well, we could have just accepted that the robot was broken. Or we found a way to make the fishing line. Isn't that neat? Isn't that nice?
Yeah, that ties up perfectly. Yeah, it's true. And the thing is, if you're determined and you believe it's going to happen, you will make it happen because your enthusiasm does rub off and it motivates the people around you to keep pushing. That's why sometimes you get the best teams together and they all motivate each other because they all believe in that one common goal and they are all so set on it working no matter what that they figure out ways to make it happen by thinking out of the box and being creative and buying a $100,000 fishing line.
All right. Well, what's a challenge that's coming up for you, Carmen? I mean, doing the weekly chat's going to be cool, but you know, you've got a lot of interesting work coming up. You've got a lot of clients pushing you to do things that maybe are just a little bit outside your comfort zone.
Yeah, I feel that the biggest challenge for me in the coming months is going to be time management. Mm. I am finding it increasingly difficult to juggle all the things, family life, school drop-offs and pickups and all that jazz with my workload. So I know that we are probably going to need to hire someone probably in the next 6 months or so to help. And I know everyone always says, do it before you feel you're ready, because if you hire when you're totally at capacity, you don't have the time to train them or do the handover or whatever. So currently I'm trying to get good processes in place so that is easier to manage. So for example,
client onboarding, that's been really good.
Yeah. So we've got a really good process now for getting clients on board. We have a call with them to find out more about what it is they need. We do the proposal, we send the proposal, we have the deep dive discovery meeting, we go away, we do the first draft. Like it's really structured now. So I feel like it wouldn't be too hard to train someone on how to do that. And recently we've outsourced podcast editing. That's been handy and it's not been taking, because that was taking me like a good 3-4 hours a week. And then about maybe like 4 or 5 months ago, we outsourced all our social media management.
Which has been great.
Which has been really good. And that's probably saved me, honestly, like
graphic design stuff. Like
about 5 hours a week, yeah. Graphic design. All the modules that Dave's been teaching through his creative writing course. I was initially doing all the workbooks and all his PowerPoint slides, and I'm like, why am I doing this? This is not the best use of my time. So we've outsourced all that, and honestly, it's like a weight has been lifted. And yeah, I just think I want to continue on that trajectory because I know that it can be really scary to hire people because obviously that's part of your income you're giving away. But it allows you to grow because obviously if I have more time on my hands, I can nurture leads in a better way. I can follow up with more people. I can go after more clients. Yeah, it does open doors, but taking that first step can be scary. Yet another challenge.
Yet another challenge, but bring them on because click your fingers, it'll be Christmas. Click your fingers, I'll be 60. Your time and tide wait for no woman or woman or man or anyone.
What are the challenges you've got coming up?
Well, second draw. I've got my new, you're looking at my new book.
So good, guys.
Which is...
so good.
Exciting. But I've got to make a lot of changes, apparently.
No, they're not huge changes.
So you say.
As your editor,
so you say.
I say, there's not massive changes to be made. No, like, I just... I'm so in awe of how you can just produce a novel that is, like, it could be on the shelves already in that form. Like, it's just mind-boggling.
It's not the first draft.
I know it's not the... it's, like, the sixth draft that yeah, you... but it's the first time a second pair of eyes have looked at it, and it's so good. I'm like, how you are so insanely talented. And it's well, not just talent, it's that you work freaking hard. But, you know, it's amazing because, obviously, I've read all your drafts of all your books. This is, like, your third book. But... if you compare your Red Gate, your very first book, to the book I won't say the name of it yet because I'm not sure if you're making it public, but your most recent novel, like, far out, the difference in the quality of the writing,
time on
the
task.
Depth of the characters, yeah. The plot, the development of the plot, the, like, quick fire pace of it, like, it's just, it's awesome to see how far you've come over that space of time, just honing your craft. So that's really cool.
You got it. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Well, it takes time. I mean, yeah, I sometimes read my first one just as a reminder, like, of not like how far I've come kind of thing, but like what I used to think writing was compared to what I know it is now. And I'm like, what will I be like in 10 years? You know, if I get to 10 years more time doing this, it's exciting. Yeah. So I've got that ahead. I've got to make that good. Well, got them. I'd say it's 95% there, but that final 5%.
Just the polish.
That's with anything. Polish. That's with anything. God, I even had a friend. He had a share house, and he had this like rent inspection with the, what do you call it? Who's the landlord? This old bloke. He came over and he said, "Boys, you've cleaned this really well. 99%, but it's the 1%." and then he went around and he showed him. He's like, "Look, you know, the skirting boards and this stuff. These are the 1%ers, guys. You've got to take care of this stuff." So after that, they had another rent inspection and then they all had a beer together. He's like, "Yeah, good on you, boys. That's 100%. So I'll never forget that. It's the 1%ers. So now I'm dusting the wainscoting and I'm vacuuming under the fridge and, you know, I'm doing all that stuff.
Vacuuming under the fridge.
Oh, I did that today, actually.
Oh, my God. You're such today. A good house husband.
Oh, I'm all right. But, yeah, God, don't call me that. Don't call me that.
Sorry.
Just, I'm someone who works at home and gets distracted. But anyway, let's probably wrap that up.
Wait, I've got a question. So how does it feel releasing a book into the world? Ooh. Like, what kind of feelings does that bring up in you, releasing such a big body of art and, you know, something that you've been working on? How long have you worked on this book for?
This particular one? Probably about 6 years.
Oh! Someone asked me that the other day and I said 3 years.
No, six.
Oh, so you started it way before Locust Summer.
This was something I worked on.
No, it was in before Locust Summer was published, way
yeah,
before.
Yeah. So this was like I called it the bottom draw book. So whenever Locust Summer went through an edit or something like that, I put Locust in the bottom drawer and took this other work
out. How did I not know this?
I have my ways. You always got to have something to do. I think you've always got to have some sort of outlet. So that was my outlet book. And this is the one this is kind of like the one I've, it's a more difficult story to tell than Locust, and it's the one I've kind of had my eye on a bit more. So, but this one, I don't have a publisher for it yet. I don't have a deal for it yet. So it's...
well, no one's read it yet, so...
no one's read it yet, but that in itself is nerve-wracking because there's, you know, yes, I've had a book out, but there's no guarantee that number two will be taken and it might be book four that gets picked up. So it's a bit of a strange time in that...
got to manifest that shit.
Exactly, but I'm also yeah, I'm also like eyes wide open. But yeah, I'm going to start sending it out and I'm confident someone will pick it up. It just depends on who that is. And, you know, so a lot of things are going to align.
Do you feel like you can be a little bit more choosy now that you have a successful novel out there?
Perhaps, perhaps. I'll at least be taken seriously at the front door that I'm knocking on instead of having to smash a window. But no, I don't know what's going to happen, and I kind of like that. I'm kind of enjoying that time. But for now, I'm trying not to get too far ahead of myself. I'm in the editing process, and I'm still devoted to making it as good as I can before I send it out. Because the thing is, once you send a book out, it's not yours anymore. It becomes the publishers, it becomes the readers, it becomes the editors, and the thing you've spent a lot of time with goes away. So, yeah, often I heard a writer say once, you know, you hear Formula One drivers talking about, you know, they get asked, you know, what was your favorite time driving, and they always say, oh, when I was a little kid driving go-karts, you know, because it's so for me, being in the writing room doing my thing, that's me doing the go-karts. But then when you actually stick the book out, that's F1. You know, that's the next level when you're actually publishing the book and promoting it. It's like a whole different sphere of experience. But when it's just you on the page, it's play and it's fun and it's, you know, probably a lot of artistic people listening would probably maybe feel the same way, but in a slightly different metaphorical sense.
Do you think a lot about what people think of your book?
No. I check Goodreads, but
you do. You're obsessed. That's why I'm like rolling my eyes internally. Because I'm like, yes, you do care.
I just want to see what happens, but no, it doesn't affect what I write.
No.
Yeah. Look, I'm interested to see if people like it or dislike it. Or I'm quite proud. I've got like 4 1-star reviews. So it's like some people just went, hell no. Like that's cool. That's like I don't know. It's like kind of a positive way of looking at it. But like,
did anyone actually comment who left?
No,
they never do. 1-star.
They never do, but it just means not for me. And I kind of like that people can have that reaction. I wouldn't want just 5-star ratings because that means it's, you know, it's like a Phil Collins song. Nothing wrong with Phil, but, you know, like everyone, it's kind of designed so that it's inoffensive.
It's so funny because it's so different to, like, reviews of a business or stuff. Because, like, obviously with a business you want all 5-star reviews, right? But when it's your art, you're like, that's okay because it's very subjective, and people either, you know, they could love it, they could hate it, they could be indifferent.
It's fun to dislike art as well. It's fun to have that argument, you know, what if someone's watched the whole, what's that old joke? It's like, the food here is terrible, yes, and such big portions. You know, like, people can't get enough of a bad thing. You know, people will hate watch Game of Thrones and then argue with people about why it's a terrible show. And other people are like, no, it's the best show ever. It's the same with art. I've persisted with books I haven't liked and then had a discussion. So it's all part of it. It's this whole different sphere. So, I mean, Locust Summer's not my book anymore. It's, you know, I get the royalties such as they are. But, you know, it's not my book anymore. So it is interesting to see how it strikes people. But it's very different. Yeah, you're right. It's very different to a business where you want everyone to have a good time. But that said, maybe that's a point a lot of people that we've spoken to on this podcast say, is that you can't please all the people all the time and you've got to do your thing.
Yeah.
And if they like it, great. If they don't, it's not for you. That's cool.
And they're not, like in terms of a business, they're not the right client for you. No. Oh, actually, I have to tell this story that happened this week. So a law firm from over east, this is just an example of when clients aren't right for you. A law firm reached out to me and they said, we really want this website written for us. We're new for law firm and we want it to look like this website. And they sent me examples of all the law firm websites. And I said, okay, that's great. Okay, so this is how the process works. We go and do the deep dive discovery meeting. It takes about 2 hours. In that meeting, we learn about your goals, the customer journey when they get to your website, the tone of voice, you know, you're writing in your services, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the lady said to me, she's like, oh, we don't have time to do that. We don't have time to do that. Can't you just make the website like the other examples I sent you and just write it from there? And I'm like, No. I said, I'm really, really sorry, but in order for me to do my best work, I really need this meeting with you because I need to find out about you. I can't just invent your law firm. Like, I can't just
Who are you? What's your name?
I can't just write it out of thin air, and I can't just copy and paste from other websites or, you know, paraphrase. I'm just thinking, you know, as a professional business, this might be clients' first port of call when they're coming to, or they're considering of hiring them as their lawyer. And I'm like, man, you just need to spend 2 hours. That's all I'm asking is 2 hours. Mm. And they weren't, you know, they were too time poor to give me 2 hours. So I said, look, I'm really sorry, but I don't think we can work together.
It's a strong move. Yeah.
And I think I knew that if I didn't, like, it could have been easy money for me, right? If I went and paraphrased these other websites and put this law firm's website together. And to be honest, I'll probably find someone like that to do that for them on Fiverr or something. But I knew that if I did that, it would not be my best work. And it would not be a website I want to display in my portfolio. And so I just said, thanks, but no thanks. And sometimes I really think you need to just be strong in your convictions about and about the kind of quality work you want to produce. And if you know the client's not going to meet you halfway and be willing to give you some of their time so that you can get it right, then perhaps they're not the client for you. You've just got to stay true to yourself, I think, when it comes to that.
That's true. I mean, I remember remember Jasmine Designs, the pricing queen and the design queen. She says similar things. Yeah, just this is my way of doing it. If it's not how you want to do it, that's cool. Here's 5 other people who maybe you can fit with. But by saying no, you're also saying yes to somebody else who you really want to work with. So, but if you went with people that you don't want to work with, it's just this sort of cascading loop where you're just doing work for work's sake. You're not doing the kind of work that you want to do. So,
and that's the whole point of working for yourself, is that you get to do the kind of work you want to do.
Yeah.
Like, what's the point? If you're just going to do work you don't really enjoy and work with clients you don't really like, you may as well go work for someone else, because you're losing that control. And working for yourself is, that's the whole point. You get to have control over choosing who you want to work with. Yeah.
That's a good point.
Should we leave it there?
We should.
We could rub it on for hours. But anyway, I hope you found this random podcast.
Yeah, it's us banging on about
various topics useful. But
here's to going all in.
Yes.
With your creative pursuits, however they are and however you wish to define them. We're going to endeavour to speak to a lot more interesting people than us about these things.
Yes. And until then, here's to going all in
on your creative pursuits. I already said that bit.
Oh, you did. Sorry. Okay.
See you later.
Bye.
And that brings us very neatly to the end of season 2 of the Committed Creative Podcast. Thank you for listening in all season, and I hope that you've got some insights from some of the people all of the people that we interviewed, including us. And we will be back with season 3 of the Committed Creative Podcast on the 8th of September. So until then, here's to going all in on your creative pursuits. Thank you for listening to the Committed Creative Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode and learned at least one thing that will help you stay on the creative path.
If you liked it, please subscribe, as there's plenty more to come. And we'd love it if you could leave us a review if you found the podcast worthwhile. And if you didn't, please send us your feedback. We're all ears. You can check us out online at redplatypuscreative.com or follow us on Facebook and Instagram at redplatypuscreative.
Remember, you are not alone in your creativity, and you can make money from your creative pursuits. See you next time when we speak to another creative mind that's committed to making their way work.
Here's to going all in and becoming a committed creative.